How old is the universe? Does the Torah agree with Darwinian evolution? Does science contradict the Torah's Genesis narrative? Although we usually stick to history on this show, we invite you to a Torah-based discussion about Charles Darwin and evolution. As always, please like and share this podcast, ask a question, or leave us a comment. Welcome to the Jewish History Podcast. I'm Rabbi Nachum Meth. Shalom, everyone. Everyone doing all right? Welcome to this special class. Darwin, Evolution, a Torah Perspective. Super excited for this class for a number of reasons. And maybe the first and the biggest reason is love teaching Torah and important ideals and lessons in Judaism and Torah. Secondly, and appropriately, is today was the 5th Yahrzeit, commemoration of the passing of my dad, Shlomo Zalman ben Yitzchak Isaac, Dr. Sheldon Z. Meth. And the Torah that we study tonight should be a merit for his neshama. And he would have loved tonight's class. I know he did love tonight's class, because whenever I talked about this kind of stuff, he would love it. Because my dad was a brilliant scientist. He was a physicist who had a deep appreciation for Torah, a deep appreciation for science, and always loved the blending of the two. So I sort of timed that this class would be on his yard site. So I thank you all for coming. Darwin, evolution, and Torah. There's almost like you could feel the tension, and that's what I'd like to talk about. Sometime in 1831, Charles Darwin sets out from England. What was supposed to be like a 2-year journey ends up being more of like a 4 or 5 year journey around the coast of South America. He was to be on the second naturalist, but the first naturalist apparently was like the scientist on the boat. What was the name of the boat? Everyone needs to know the name of the boat that Darwin was on. For some reason, they teach high school kids the Beagle. We don't know anything about anything. I can't tell you, we don't know. But the Beagle, we need to know that Darwin was on the Beagle. So very good. You were paying attention. Your history teacher is proud somewhere. The Beagle. So Darwin set sail on the Beagle for what would end up being 5 years around the coastline of South America. And it was on that journey. He was actually the second naturalist. There was the chief scientist, but the captain of the boat got into a fight with the chief scientist, they were called the naturalist. So Darwin became the chief scientist on that boat. And it was on this journey, Darwin was a young kid. He was kind of like a lost soul, needed something to do. He came from a wealthy family. So he figured he'd study nature. And it was on that voyage where he was really curious about speciation. Hard word to say. Speciation, the different species and what they were all, where, you know, their similarities, their dissimilarities. And famously, when he was on that trip in the Galapagos Islands, if you remember, I'm sure everyone remembers their biology, he saw the finches. He didn't think they were finches. He thought they were different types of sparrows. He thought some of them were actually new breeds of birds. He sent the specimens home, and of course, some other scientists said, no, these different, they looked totally different one from another. And sure enough, what were they? They were all different finches. And it's when he returned, beginning in mid-July of 1837, Darwin starts scribbling all of his notes down on his different notebooks. And famously, in notebook B of transmutation of species, he comes up with what would be his theory of evolution. He spent the next 22 years until 1859, really the first 2 or 3 years after he got back from his journey, where he really started writing, at least in his privately, he didn't publish anything about this, in his notebooks about his theory of evolution. It wouldn't be till 1859 that he actually published his famous book. Very good. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm the teacher. I'm testing everyone. Very good. I'll let you out for extra recess if you get more questions right. Origin of Species. What was he doing for those 22 years? No one knows. It's one of those great questions in science, in history of science. What was Darwin doing for 20 years? We don't really know. He was a hypochondriac of awesome magnitude. He had a vomiting problem. He would throw up all the time. He was wealthy, and he got himself married, had 10 kids, buried several of them, but married his wife, who, you know, thought his husband, or believed that her husband was a heretic, which he was. But they had a good marriage. Emma Wedgwood of China fame. Her uncle, you ever heard of Wedgwood? Yeah, that's her. So interesting. No one knew that on your Trivial Pursuit. That would have been amazing if you got that. In 1859, he publishes Origins of Species. I'm assuming that everyone knows the basic theory of evolution, which basically points out, and Darwin pointed out, that we know in nature, certainly in the 1850s, even in the 1830s, scientists, naturalists, people who are well aware of artificial selection. We breed cows for the cows that we want. We breed tomatoes for the bright red, juicy, plump tomatoes. What we do is we discard the tomatoes that we don't like. We artificially select tomatoes that we do like. And thus, the inheritance of those desired traits of those tomatoes, cows, or whatever they may be, are transferred forward to the next generation. That was artificial selection. And of course, Darwin surmises that the reason why this happens is because of there's natural variation. Children vary slightly, they vary slightly from their parents. And he had this theory. Maybe this is true in the nature as well. Maybe there's natural selection that naturally will select different species, as again, species naturally will vary. So maybe the species of fruits, finches, turtles, or whatever it may be, that have traits that are more desirable for survival, those will survive, as Darwin would write. As many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and as consequently there is a frequently recurring struggle for existence, it follows that any being, if it vary however slightly in any manner profitable for itself, under the complex and sometimes varying conditions of life, will have a better chance of surviving and thus be naturally selected. From the strong principle of inheritance, any selected variety will tend to propagate its new and modified form. And this is what we call, ladies and gentlemen, survival of the fittest. And this is evolution. And he pondered and he thought that this idea of evolution would actually explain speciation. This is how different species emerge. And as I mentioned, his famous bee notebook, he already back in the 1830s, he recognized this is a little bit of heresy, because if you believe in evolution, you don't need to believe in God. And sort of hedging, it's very interesting, famous, it's Google it, it's all over the internet. In his notebook, the bee notebook, where he draws out that first tree with branches of species, and it's almost to hedge against his heresy, he writes in the top left corner, "I think," as if to say, I'm not that big of a kofer be'ikr, I'm not that big of a heretic, I'm not sure. But sure, he was, he actually stop believing in God. And although it's interesting, as I mentioned, his wife was definitely devout, devout Christian. They had a happy marriage, which is interesting. Of course, and that was his theory of evolution. It wouldn't be till Gregor Mendel, if you really remember remember Gregor Mendel. If Darwin just has this idea of evolution, he had no idea what is the mechanism of heredity. He had no concept, he had no idea. He just knew that this idea of natural selection, survival of the fittest. But meanwhile, there was this monk in a monastery, not too far away, but basically playing around with peas. That was what he was playing around with. And it was Gregor Mendel who was mixing and matching different peas and how big they were and the small they were. Do you remember drawing in your AP bio the Mendel boxes? You remember dominant, recessive? Benny's like, "I don't know what you're talking about." You'll get there one very soon, Benny. You're going to have to do this. And we all, it's the rite of passage for being an adult, as you have to go through and suffer through biology. And of course, it was Mendel who would discover and really coin the idea, the notion of genetics, that there are inheritable traits that we pass over, thereby really explaining the pathway for evolution. Genes that are more adaptive for a particular species, for survival, those genes, which are a result of the natural variation among species, that's what's going to be the sort of the vehicle for evolution. And of course, it wouldn't be until the 1950s where Francis Crick and James Watson, who's still alive, right? What did they discover? They really discovered the molecular explanation for genetics, which is really the explanation for evolution. Of course, what did they discover in 1953 it was, as they discovered DNA, they were able to really identify and map out the structure of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, which is the code of all life. It's based on DNA, which is a series of roughly 3 billion nucleic acids. Sorry, actually, I can never remember. I just know ATC and G. Does anyone remember what they are by heart? Okay. Go for it. ATC. But what are they? There you go. So it's, thank you. Cytosine, guanine, adenine, and thymine, ACT and G. For again, my AP, I did well in AP bio in 11th grade. And of course, the DNA, it's that sequence of 3 billion ACTs and Gs, creates a sequence. Every 3 ATCs and Gs, every sequence of 3 creates an amino acid. You string together a bunch of amino acids. You get yourself a protein. You put yourself enough proteins together. You have yourself organelles, put enough organelles together. You got cells, put enough cells together. You got tissue, put enough tissue together. You got an organ, put enough organs together. You get systems, put enough systems together. And what do you have? You have an organism. And you have your, you know, people or dogs. And of course, it's with DNA, we now understand the process of how evolution can take place. And what's happening, evolution is, although we have these ATCs and Gs, every now and again there are mutations. And children, offspring, will inherit a funny copy, a mix and a match, of their parents' DNA, and they'll have their own specific blend. There'll be natural variations, and it's with DNA and with the natural mutations which within the DNA creates the natural variants, which creates potential for natural selection, which creates survival of the fittest, which creates evolution, which creates Darwin. And now we can explain Darwin, and that's evolution in a nutshell. Everyone, thank you for coming. You got evolution. Now, the reality is there is evidence to evolution. There is scientific evidence that really backs up the notion of evolution. Many have argued, isn't it interesting? Do you know if you compare yourself with the tree that's outside, with a single cell amoeba, with a chimpanzee, with my dog Cody, your DNA and virtually all life form, you're like 90% something in common, your genetic code. Isn't it interesting that all life is made up of DNA from, you know, bacteria, even viruses, which are, we don't even know what those things are. Everything is made up of DNA. Now, doesn't that really support the notion of evolution? Think about it. If species were, and it was in the beginning, and God created, you know, dogs, and God created boys, and God created fleas, wouldn't you expect God to create boys with boyness and fleas with fleeness and dogs out of dog? Why do we all have the same molecular component, the same code of life, DNA? And you could just well imagine if we're 2% the same, a couple tweaks here and there, that really can explain or pushes in the direction of evolution. We find extinct species that show evolutionary epochs in the archaeology, Neanderthals, and other species which seem to show, let's talk about humans and humanoids, as an evolutionary process from apes of sorts. We do find it in the archaeological record. Vestigial organs. Let's talk about mankind. The appendix, the tailbone, wisdom teeth, ear muscles, the inside corner of eyes. Vestigial organs. These are organs that have no function within humanity. A tailbone. Wouldn't that seem to indicate that at once upon a time, humans had tails? Again, suggesting evolution has some kind of scientific basis. As a matter of fact, we have examples where we can actually see evolution occur before us. Famously, again, I apologize everyone, keep on sending you back to 9th grade biology, but it's actually a very cool example. Do you remember the story with the moths in London? Do you remember the story? It's a great example. The moths in London in the late 1800s, the moths in London all died except for certain mutated moths. The moths that had darker pigment in their, whatever it is, skin, I don't know what they have. Darker pigmented moths. And all the light-colored moths died out in like the 1880s. And of course, why? Because in London, what's going on in the 1880s? The Industrial Revolution. They're burning coal. And everything is covered in soot, and everything becomes darker. And if you're a light-skinned moth, and you're trying to camouflage yourself on that tree, well, now that tree got darker, and you're bright, and guess what happens? All the birds see you, and they eat you for dinner. But if you've been mutated to be darker colored, now you blend in with the darker environment behind you. And we have evidence of moth. That's evolution. Survival of the fittest. Natural selection. The birds selected the lighter colored moths. The darker pigmented moths survived. You can take bacteria, put it in a petri dish, insert something. Those things propagate generationally every like 10 seconds. So you get generation after generation, speed it up in petri dishes. You insert, what do you put in? Some kind of antibiotic. It'll wipe out 99.999% of all the bacteria, but the 0.0001% survived. Why? Because they had some kind of natural variation, some kind of mutation in their genetic makeup that made them resistant to that antibiotic. Guess what? That's survival of the fittest. And now that 0.001%, they survived. Now what happens? They keep on propagating. They have descendants. And what happens? You now grow a strain of antibacterially resistant bacteria. That, ladies and gentlemen, is evolution. So we have scientific examples, scientific evidence, which suggests that evolution is a real thing. Terrific. But the reason why we're all here tonight is for the last clause in the title, Darwin and Evolution, a Torah perspective. Because, of course, evolution from its onset ran contrary with theology. And what we would like to do today is try to detangle that connection, these notions of evolution and the Torah perspective. There are really two theological problems from a Jewish perspective, when we talk about evolution. Number one is it's against the biblical narrative. And it was in the beginning. Bereshis bara Elokim, etzei shamayim v'saaretz, v'aretz haisa sov, v'vavo, v'ruach al pnei ha'am, v'ruach al-kim, v'ruach al pnei ha'amayim. Doesn't say anything about Darwin, doesn't say anything about the different finches on the Galapagos Islands. It says, and there vayi erev, vayi boker, and there was evening, and there was morning. God saw it and it was good. Doesn't say anything about evolution. That's nowhere in Genesis chapter 1 or chapter 2. It goes against the Torah narrative. The process is just completely not what the Torah describes. The process of the 6 days of creation, God resting on the seventh, that goes nowhere in sync with the process, as it were, of evolution. Number two, or maybe number one, we're going to actually tackle this question first, is evolution, for evolution to work, you need a lot of time. Things don't evolve quickly. It takes many, many, many generations of trial and error for evolution to play itself out. Millions, hundreds of millions of years. According to Jewish tradition, if you read the Torah and you just reverse engineer the Torah, we are in year 5784 from creation. How does that jive with evolution? 5,784, that's not enough time for evolution to do its wonders. So we have two problems. A, it's against, well, we have one problem. This is 1A and 1B. Is that it's against the Torah narrative, both in terms of the process, both in terms of the age of the universe. Number two, there's a second problem. And this was the problem that Darwin really suffered from. This is, once I have evolution to explain the origin of species, I don't need God anymore. I can now delete God, at least a lot of God. Should be noted that Darwin himself, there's a different field of evolution. Evolution, strictly speaking, Darwinian evolution doesn't speak to a different thing called abiogenesis, which is terrific. We can explain that humans came from apes and dogs and speciation. Where did the first cell of life come from? That first moment of life is called abiogenesis, Darwin didn't speak to that, and evolution doesn't speak to that. And that's a whole different field. So in theory, Darwin could say, we needed God to create that first cell of life. But after that, shalom God, we don't need God anymore. We don't see God anywhere. We do not see the hand of God in the world and universe around us. And that can create some real problems, as we'll see. And what I would like to do today is to try to sort of tackle these two or three problems. Number one, that evolution seems to go against the Torah narrative. And then number two, evolution seems to run against the need for God in our lives. Am I making sense? So let's start. It goes against the biblical narrative because let's first talk about the process of the biblical narrative. We read in the Torah, chapter 1 of Genesis. Doesn't say anything about evolution. Doesn't say anything about evolution. But the truth of the matter is, and this is an important point, and I want to also just really be careful about one very important thing. The point of today's lecture, there will be no apologetics. I don't believe in apologizing for the Torah. This is not apologetics. This is classic sources, classic ideas in Judaism, and I want to present them, and no apologies here. But the reality is, even without that introduction, if you look at Genesis chapter 1, you're going to come across all sorts of funny verses. And I didn't bring a chumash. Benny, can you do me a favor? There's a chumash in the bookcase outside on the stone chumash, if you could get me a copy. Thank you. Round of applause for my help. Thank you, Benny. If you read Genesis chapter 1, you're going to have some real problems. Bereishis bara Elokim es hashamayim es haaretz, beginning the creation of the heavens and the earth. Thank you, Benny. Let's read Genesis 1:2. Of course, we read, V'ha'aretz ha'isa sohu v'vohu v'choshech al p'nei tahom, v'ruach Elokim merachafes al p'nei hamayim. When the earth was astonishingly empty, with darkness upon the surface of the deep, and the divine presence hovered upon the surface of the waters. Does anyone know what that verse means? I don't. And this is going to be a recurring theme when it comes to Genesis 1. It's very difficult to really understand. Take evolution, ignore evolution for a minute. The Torah's process of creation is very difficult to understand. We need to keep that in mind. I'll give another example. The verse tells us, verse 6, Vayomer Elokim yihi rakia besoch hamayim, v'hi mavdil bein mayim l'mayim. God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate between water and water. Could someone please draw me a picture of a firmament? It's a word that comes up a lot in Genesis, is this rakia, the firmament. I believe, let me look at my notes. Right. Rabbeinu Avram ben HaRambam, the Rambam's son, he writes, he says, this rakia thing, we don't really know what it means. Classic source, we don't really know what the what is this rakia? Not sure. Ramban, by Moshe Nachman, he's a classic source, he writes so beautifully, or tellingly, he tells us, HaPirish besidur haksuvim bezeh, the explanation of these verses, he's talking about specifically about the narrative of the Genesis narrative, bezeh nizgav v'nelam, it's lofty, v'nelam, it's hidden. V'daitenu ba, in our understanding of the process of creation, pachos mitipa min hayam hagadol, is less than a drop in the Atlantic Ocean. We don't really understand the process of creation. So it's a very hard question to answer. Evolution goes against the Genesis narrative. Well, let's be honest. All the commentaries really point out the Genesis narrative is a little bit difficult to understand. So it's a little bit like comparing apples to the unknown. So it's hard to answer the question if I don't know the two things that I'm comparing. Ramban himself actually points out, he talks about in Genesis, in that second verse, this idea of creation. He explains, again, it's a lot of mystical, Kabbalistic notions. He explains that when we say that God, that the world was tohu vavohu, astonishingly empty, he says that the God initially created, when he creates the universe, he creates hiyuli, which is a Greek philosophical term, which means primordial matter. God created the world, he created sort of like this primordial matter, and it was from that matter that God created the whole universe. What does that mean? What does that look like? Difficult question to answer. So I'm going to put a big circle around that first question. Doesn't the evolutionary process go against the Torah narrative in Genesis 1? I would say like this, possibly, probably, but it's a very difficult question to answer because we don't really have, as opposed to the entire Torah, you know, the rest of the Torah, we have a much better working knowledge of what the Torah is telling us. Genesis 1 is very difficult to have a working pshat, a working understanding, so it's going to be very difficult to be able to reconcile it with any scientific questions. But that leads us to question number 2. Fine, so Rabbi, you get a pass for that one. We don't really know the Genesis narrative. But we do know, and we do believe, and I do believe, ani ma'amin be'emunah shleimah, I believe, we, according to Jewish tradition, are in the year 5784. We're going to do a science experiment, everyone. Everyone ready? You don't have to do this, but if you want, this is an amazing science experiment. You ever wonder how scientists, they go and they say, well, what's it? Alpha Centauri, it's the closest, I think, galaxy. And it's whatever it is, I have no idea. It's a billion, it's a million light years away. What yardstick are they using to measure that it's a million light years away? How do you measure? It's not 2 million, It's not a half a million, it's a million. Really? How do they figure that out? It's actually a very simple thing. It's a good high school, you know, 12th grade trigonometry. You could figure this out. Everyone want to do this math? Sorry. 12th grade, right? You want to do a little math experiment? It's very cool. Do the following. Everyone look at, okay, I'm kind of facing the wrong way, but look right here. You see this black line? Do the following. Cover your left eye. Cover your left eye. Stick your right finger out like that. Line up your finger so that it's covering this black line. Does everyone understand what I'm saying? So you shouldn't see that you're going like that. On the count of three, what you're going to do is with your left eye, with your left hand that's covering your left eye, you're going to switch and cover your right eye. And you're going to, so you're going to open your left. Okay? The count of three. One, two, three. What happened? It moved. So not only am I a rabbi who knows nothing about science, I'm a magician too. Thank you all for coming. What happened there? How did I get this thing to move? Right? This is called the reason why it moves. You know why it moved? Because your eyeballs are about 6 centimeters apart. Okay? And when you look from this way, so your finger is lined up, when you go like this, the fact that there's a little bit of a distance, your finger is going to move relative to what you see behind it. We know, based on other scientific calculations, what the orbit of the Earth around the sun is, and the radius of the Earth around the sun. If you know that piece of information, so you know your eyes are 6 centimeters apart, by calculating how much your finger shifted based on what's behind it, you can now tell how far your finger is from right between your eyeballs. It's called parallax angles. It's using basic trigonometry. Once you know that this is six, it's just measure the angles. You see how far it shifted. Google it. You'll see it's not that complicated math. You're a good 12th grade student. You'll figure it out. So we went from, again, biology to trigonometry. That's called parallax angles. And based on that, you can tell that that star, you could do that with heavenly bodies, because think about it. The Earth goes around the sun. So if we measure that star in, you know, January, and it's over there, on the other side, if let's say, right, it orbits around the sun, and then we can see how far the sun, that star is, how far it's shifted 6 months later, you can now calculate, and we know how far the Earth has traveled as a radius, you can now calculate how far away any distant star is. Using that, you can then reverse engineer, well, if it's that many billion miles away and you can tell that things are moving, certainly after the 1920s when we discovered the universe is expanding, well, you just now just figure out the rate of speed, how fast things are going, and you can determine the age of the universe. There are other mathematical things using things called redshift. As light moves farther away, it shifts toward the red end of the spectrum. Background microwave radiation. There are other things that different, it's not that complicated science. And we can determine, scientists will determine, that the universe is approximately 13.5 billion years old. That gives enough time for evolution to happen, but that again will go against the Torah narrative. So that's a big problem. That's a big problem. Now, the hazards to answering this question. There's a big challenge, just an occupational hazard before we try to answer this question. How do we reconcile the universe being 13.5, give or take, billion years, and 5,784? Occupational hazard. What you might be tempted to do is say, no, really, if you read the Torah carefully, 5,784 is a metaphor, and really it means 13.5 billion years. Let's say you were to do that. Somehow, word of caution, we believe that the universe today is 13.5 billion years old. A new study just came out that says, no, we think it's actually 26.3 billion years old. And in 50 years, they're going to come up with some new scientific calculation. So what's going to happen? If in 50 years they say, no, the universe is, whatever, 36 billion years old. Now you're left with no Torah, and you're left with no science, and you're left nowhere. So you got to be very careful answering these questions. So one approach is just to simply say the science is wrong. They're wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. I don't think that's a good answer. I don't think it's a compelling answer. We believe in science to some degree. You know, that's, I go to the doctor when I'm sick. So I'm just going to reject the scientific thinking. So there was a rabbi, he's still alive, his name is Rabbi Slifkin. He got himself into trouble when he talked about, and he read Genesis chapter 1, and he said when it talks about God creating the world, the universe in 6 days and resting on the seventh, it doesn't really mean days, it means epochs. He had six ideas, six concepts. And really, if you read the Genesis narrative, it's billions of years old. So aside from violating this first principle, he got himself into a lot of trouble with mainstream Torah thinking, because that's not what the Torah says. It says days. It doesn't say God had ideas. And he got himself into a little bit of trouble, and it certainly doesn't seem to be like the pshat. Others want to posit or suggest that when it says days, I'll ask you a question. It says God created 6 days of creation. God doesn't create the sun. The sun's not even created on the first day. So what does that even mean? God created, there was, Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker, Yom Echad, that there was morning, there was a day, the first day of creation. There wasn't even a sun and planets. So maybe a day indeed is a concept. It's billions of years. Problem is, and that maybe that's true, but Ramban, Rabbi Moshe Nachmanides, himself asks this question, and he says when it means day, it's a borrowed term. How long is a day? 24 hours. So you don't need 24 hours on a clock, you don't need earth and the sun for 24 hours. He says when the Torah says days, it means 7 days of 24 hours. Meaning, the creation, the Jewish tradition that we're 5,784 years, you know, from creation, Ramban says that's quite literal. Something to think about is we talk about time in general, talk about Einstein and relativity. Time is a difficult thing to measure. We now know that time is relative. So when we say that the universe is 5,000 years old, from whose vantage point? It's an interesting perspective. And there are several other potential stabs that people have thrown over the years to try to explain or resolve these problems. But I want to tell you a definitive idea in Torah and in Judaism, and it's in a certain respect one of the most important and crucial ideas you will ever hear when it comes to understanding the Torah and appreciating the world around us. What came first, the chicken or the egg? From a Torah perspective, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Chicken. Why do you say the chicken? How do you know? You're right. It said so. Read the verse. The verse says, Chapter 1, verse 12. Vayomer Elokim Tachei Aretz Desha Esav Mazria Zera Eitz Peri Osa Pri Limino Asher Zara Bo'al Aretz Vayichein. Chapter 1, verse 11. God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, herbage yielding seed, fruit trees yielding fruit. Not seeds yielding trees, but fruit trees yielding fruit. As a matter of fact, the Medrash says, the Medrash Rabbah, for those who are keeping score at home, the Medrash Rabbah 14:7, Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon Omer, Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon says, Ofer olam al malayaso nivra, the world was created al malayaso, complete. Amar Rabbi Eliezer bar Shimon af Chava al malayaso nivres, Chava was created, Eve was created fully complete. Amar Rabbi Yochanan adam Chava kivnei esrim shana nivru, when Adam and Eve were created, they were 20 years old. Talmud tells us in Chulin Sadler of Yeshua ben Levi, to Amar Yeshua ben Levi, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, Kol Maisei Bereshis Bekomoso Nivru. The entire narrative of creation, Bekomoson, in their, really means in their stature, but I think in this sense it means in their completed form they were created. Bedaito Nivru, they were created with their full knowledge. Betsivyonam Nivru, I think, which means in their full color. I think it means in their full form. Let me ask you a question. We got a physician in the house. Okay, yeah, we see the physicians here. If you, I stick you in Rabbi Meth's time machine, right? You think this is a computer, it's a time machine. And I put you in this time machine and we send you back 10 minutes after creation. And you do a physical on Adam and Eve, right? You do a workup, blood, measure all the vitals. What are your instruments going to tell you? What age person are you looking at? The Medrash tells us clearly your records and all your instrumentations, all your measurements will tell you that Adam is a healthy 20-year-old male and Eve is a healthy 20-year-old female. But I don't get it. She's 10 minutes old. Shouldn't she be a newborn? God created a fully formed universe. If you were to be in a time warp, Medrash tells us very clearly, 10 minutes after creation, and you go to the Grand Canyon, you know what you would see? The Grand Canyon. Even though the Grand Canyon appears to be hundreds of millions of years old. I like it to faded jeans. Anyone ever buy faded jeans? Have you ever worn non-faded jeans? I'm a rabbi, I don't wear jeans. But jeans, natural denim, is impossible to wear, right? Stiff and tough and like you can't move in it. So what do? You wash your jeans, right? And the more you wash it, the more broken it gets and the better it looks and all of that, right? What did denim makers realize 100 years ago? People don't like stiff denim. So what did they do? They pre-washed them for you and they pre-faded them for you. Do you know how they make your jeans? Denim naturally is very stiff. They take it, they wash it, they put it in washing machines, and they put rocks in the washing machines. I'm not joking. In the tumbler, they put rocks into the washing machine to break in your jeans. I found on one article it said, I thought I copied and pasted it. It was a very cool article. How about this guy? He started a new jeans company and he got these special stones from these volcanic islands. He liked those stones to break in. He ordered like tons of these stones. The guy went and he thought he was crazy. He's like, you have to explain. No, really, I'm an architect and I'm building some building out of stones. He just needed it to break in his jeans. So you go to the store and you buy your jeans. It's a brand new set of jeans. But because of the process, it actually looks like and feels like and detects like a pair of jeans that's 10 years old. God created a world fully formed. So you want to know why the universe looks and feels like it's 13 billion years old? Because guess what? That's how God created it. You know, we talk about my dad and his yard site. This was an item, as I mentioned, my dad was a deeply pious Jew. Wore a big yarmulke on his head. He worked for the Defense Department, was always in the Pentagon. Everything he did was top secret. PhD from Columbia, the whole thing. And he was a deeply devout Jew. And I would always say that my dad, whenever he would come to Vegas, he would go to Red Rock Canyon, and he would point out the different strata of stone and rock and say, oh, that's from, you know, this era and that era and that, the Jurassic era and all that stuff, hundreds of millions of years old. And then he would say in the same breath, Marabu Masecha Hashem Kulam Bechachma Asisa Malah Haaretz Kinyonecha, how awesome are your creations, O God. Kulam bichachma asisa, everything was made with wisdom. Mala haaretz kinyanecha, the world is full of your creation. The world is testimony to your creation. Well, Dad, which one is it? Is it the Jurassic era and 100 million years ago? Or is it God and 5,000 years ago? And the answer is, and this was something that I was always brought up with, and to me, it was such a part of the fabric of my understanding and outlook, is that science and Torah virtually never conflict, because guess what? Guess who created science? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God. The same way gravity operates. And we say, well, where did that come from? God created gravity. Electromagnetism. How does that work? Why does that work? We can measure it, detect it, and do all the tests in the world to prove electromagnetism is a thing. It's terrific. And science, and explore it, and be overwhelmed by the beauty and majesty of the science. That's not fighting God, that's evidence to God. Why is that happening? God created science. I don't know why God created the universe, but the whole question of the age of the universe is based on a presupposition that I don't know where we came up with it. The presupposition is such that we expect that if I put the universe under my microscope, I'm going to clearly see God. I'm clearly going to see the Genesis narrative. I'm clearly going to see a universe being 5,784 years old. The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah tells us that God created the heavens and the earth. And for whatever reason, he created nature so that it's a little bit concealed. The trick isn't that you're going to somehow find a microscope and find God particle. You're never going to, science has been looking for that God particle, but you're never going to find the God particle. The whole trick is to see the natural particles, to see the nature of science, and say, where did all of this come from? Se'u einechem maram ure'u, says Isaiah. Raise your eyes to the heavens and perceive, mi bara ela. Where did all this come from? That is how we find God. So if the universe, science tells us it's 13 point whatever billion, great. Great. That means when God created the heavens and the earth 5,784 years ago, he made it appear that that's how aged it would be. Why did God do that? Kedas Yitzchak, who's writing in the 1400s, he says, when God created nature, he made it such that you can study nature and explain the world around us. Because if there was a God particle, if it was that if you just looked in the Hubble telescope, which my dad worked on, if you looked through the Hubble telescope and you saw God, guess what? There would be no Bechira, there would be no free will. The whole point of our existence is so that we work on ourselves to be able to see the hidden hand of God. If God's hand wasn't so hidden, guess what? We wouldn't have very many temptations in life. And the whole point of life is to exercise our free will to be able to see God and bring God into our lives. So we've just answered the age of the universe. And in theory, if we ended here, we can really walk away and say we've answered evolution as well. In theory. Because a person could say, well, look, if evolution, science tells us that evolution is true. And man has evolved from chimpanzees and everything. We're all part of Darwin's tree of evolution from some single cell amoeba, 100 gazillion years ago. So in theory, we could just walk home and say, that's true, that's fine, because that's how God created the universe. It has that appearance. We don't know the process of creation. God, when he created the world 5,784 years ago, he created the universe to appear like evolution. You, in theory, can say that and walk home, mazel tov, shalom, thank you all for coming, have some coffee on the way out. And in theory, we'd be fine, and that would answer the question, and it does answer the question. I do think there's a second problem, though, and it's something I want to touch on before we end, is that isn't so great, because our sages teach us that seeing God in nature, as we mentioned, Su'u'ei necha mara mar'umi bara ela, as Isaiah tells us, look at nature and see God. Chovos Havavos actually tells us that's a religious imperative. We are all charged to look at nature, be inspired, see the handiwork of God. Chovos Havavos writes, examination of created things means a close study of the elements of which the universe is composed, the products that result from the combination of these elements, the character of the constituents of each composite, the marks of wisdom exhibited in its production, form, and shape, and the purpose of which it was created, the beautiful spirituality of this world, it causes and effects, and the complete perfection for which it was created. He tells us, it's higher and lower. And to realize that the Creator created the universe in a perfect and orderly combination, each of its parts distinctly recognizable, so that it hints and teaches of the Creator, as a work points to the workman, or a house indicates a builder, beginning, Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim v'sa'aretz. Chovos Havavos, writing in, we don't know when, probably in the 1300s, tells us, study nature, study science, we should be motivated to see God. A big part of Judaism is to look at speciation, and look at the neflos ha-borei, look at the various creatures, creeping and crawling and flying and swimming, and we should say, wow, these things are amazing, I see God here. Well, Darwin, if we really do believe in evolution, it's not really all that inspiring. Because it's just evolution, survival of the fittest, natural selection, mutation, genetics, DNA, A, T, C, and G. It becomes a little harder. Evolution, although it could fit in theory with a Jewish notion, it really takes away or can take away from our appreciation of the Bria, of the world around us. I think it's therefore, it behooves us to take a moment and actually try to, this is an important thing. One of my rabbis, who actually studied a lot from Rabbi Lapiansky, he's a brilliant rabbi in where I'm from, in Silver Spring. He always mentions like a word of caution. I'm not a scientist, and I'm guessing no one here has really studied evolutionary biology. And on the one hand, I have a certain deference. We have to have a certain deference to science. We all kind of live that way to some degree. But he would always say, on the other hand, there's a certain temptation or a certain hesitation we need to have the second someone puts on a lab coat and says, I'm a scientist, so okay, whatever you say goes. And that's not good either. I'll give you an example. God forbid you or a loved one are ill, really seriously ill. And you go in front of the doctor, and the doctor says, we need to, aggressive treatment. We're going to do aggressive chemo. I'm the doctor. I'm wearing the lab coat. You have to listen to me, right? A hammer sees the world as nails. a surgeon. That's his point of view, but maybe he's not taking into account all the other factors. Maybe he's not understanding and taking into account the psychology of the patient. Maybe he's not, you know, because he's into chemo, he doesn't see surgery as an option. He doesn't, might not necessarily see the whole picture. So what do we do as a patient or a loved one of a patient? It's our job to educate ourselves as best as we can and not just to follow blindly. The doctor said do it, so I'm going to do it. We do the best that we can to get a layman's understanding of what our options are. And ultimately, we have to be the ones to make judgments for our own lives when it comes to our medical care and when it comes to our core beliefs. It's very dangerous to just say a scientist said evolution is true, so I'm going to follow it. Or a scientist said X is true, so now my core religious beliefs, my whole outlook on the world and the universe and life, I'm just going to kind of follow it because the scientist said that. We need to have a healthy dose of skepticism, not just be a total cynic and say, science, they don't know what they're talking about, but much like in a scenario of a medical scenario, you got to get a layman's understanding and try to make a best evaluation that you can. I would just point out an important thing. With this original, this notion that we just explained, that God is the one who created nature and God is the one who created the universe, how it, you know, aged as it were, we're now sort of in a freed position. We're unshackled. We don't have to believe in evolution. We don't not have to believe in evolution. Let's take an honest look at it, see if it makes sense. There are several major, major problems with evolution that the truth of the matter is have yet to really be resolved. This isn't Rabbi Math talking. These are things that you, we, all of us need to really contemplate and consider. You know, do we really believe that this is true? One of the classic examples, talk about evolution. The big problems, some of the biggest problems in evolution, what big challenge that evolution has to deal with, is we talk about conceptual evolution versus physical evolution. So we see evolution from a bike to a motorcycle to a car to an airplane. It's evolution. That's a conceptual evolution. You can see it going from smaller to bigger. But physical evolution, we realize the difference between a bike and a motorcycle are engines, are carburetors, are a million and one components. The difference between a motorcycle and a car are a billion components. And the difference between a car and an airplane or a boat are even more components. In concept, we can see the progression. But to realize from a physical perspective, there is a huge amount of steps between the two. If evolution, the whole premise of evolution is that steps that, or mutations that are beneficial for the survival of a species will be propagated and survival of the fittest will make it naturally selected, that's great. But half of an engine is useless. Half of an engine, you know, from a bike, as it started evolving to create an engine, it would be useless. And the question that science really struggles with, you know, it's nice in concept, but in practicality, there are a million things that need to happen for a car engine to work. So for example, one of the examples they always talk about is the human eye. You probably heard this, and it's a very, very powerful argument. The human eye is an incredibly complicated structure. If parts of it aren't working, it's a useless organ. Now, yes, there are cells, very basic cells in certain simple amoeba that are sensitive to light. They flicker as the light goes, you know, as things get brighter and darker. So science, evolution would say, the eyeball came as an evolutionary byproduct to single cell organisms that are more receptive or sensitive to light. Again, that's a conceptual gradation in evolution. But the physical differences between a single cell that has certain photoreceptivity and the structure of the human eye is like the difference, it's actually a million times bigger than the difference of, let's say, a bike to a motorcycle. And this is one of the big challenges that evolution struggles with are, you know, these intermediate steps are very, very difficult, to see. Another big problem that evolution still really doesn't have a great answer for is bilateral evolution. There are so many biological processes in the universe today that require two completely unrelated things to happen. Two completely unrelated biological functions need to happen to have the creation of a third biological byproduct. The most obvious example, reproduction, male and female. You need males to in any organism. If all you have is male, where did females come from? It doesn't work. There are so many forms of, I'll give another example. I read a book, it's an amazing book. It's called Run for Your Life. Anyone wanna read that? It's about, anyone into running? Any joggers here? Amazing book. If you are, read it. It's a great book called Run for Your Life, about a guy who's all into jogging and running. And he, in the introduction of the book, it's so beautiful and inspiring. He talks about the mechanism of running. And he talks about how many muscles and the billion and different muscle groups need to be activated for every step that we take, every stride that we make, all the different steps that go into it. For you to take one step, think of the different systems that need to be in place. Your bones need to be there. Your muscles need to be there. Your bones without your muscles are useless. If you have bones and muscles so that you can run, but you have no nerves, so you're not going to feel the earth below you and you will topple over. So you need a nervous system. Balance. You need something in your ears to make sure that you're balanced. If you take one of those things out, you can't run. So how do you have this bilateral evolution? It's one thing if, you know, you had a single cell amoeba and it started being able to move itself with a tail of some sort. But you don't, it's not just, you know, one mechanism that gets you to run. It's bones, it's muscles, it's nerves, it's brains, it's all sorts of things. That's a very difficult question that evolution doesn't really have an answer for. Taking it a step deeper, there's a book that I brought over here. It's called Darwin's Black Box. It's actually not a great book. I don't recommend it. It's a very technical book. But he goes through this on a molecular level. You know, we talk about running and the different systems. For any action to happen in your body, it's not just, you know, well, there's a muscle that contracted in your bones and your nerves. Things actually happen on a molecular level. Something like blinking your eye. There's like 30 molecular processes that have to happen for you to blink your eye. You delete one of those molecular reactions, the whole chain falls apart. Again, evolution can't really explain that. Evolution can explain what, like, gradations. You know, once upon a time, there was a horse, and it had a little bit of a bigger neck, and that allowed it to get berries that were a little higher. So it inherited those genes of a little bit bigger necks to its offspring. Multiply that a couple billion generations, what do you have? A giraffe. Because, right, natural variation, you're going to have certain animals that have bigger necks. We get it. That's a matter of gradation. But when you're talking a process of 30 things or hundreds of things that need to happen molecularly, if one of them falls apart, that wouldn't be inherited. It goes against the rules of, evolution. One of the big problems archaeologically is, yes, we have seen things like Neanderthals and different species that seem to bridge the gap, let's say, between humans, humanoids, apes. But again, evolution doesn't work A, B, C. Evolution works in scales. Why is there nothing in between humans and Neanderthals? We don't find in the archaeological record a gradient. We find, yes, different species that are extinct, that if you have humans over here, apes over here, you might have 5 or 6 different types in between, but you would expect a gradient of hundreds, if not thousands, of a slow gradation making its way from A to B. We don't find that in any kind of archaeological record. Snakes, alligators, elephants, amoebas, we don't find that. One of the biggest problems, when you talk about bilateral evolution, this is way beyond my pay scale, but if you understand how DNA and proteins work. You know, if you want to talk about evolution, an example, you have a wonderful recipe. Delicious chalent. Come to my house for a Shabbos lunch, you have chalent. And it's amazing. And you have a great, come over to my house, Shabbos morning, everyone's invited, you have this chalent. And you come over and you say, Rabbi, how do you make that chalent? It's an amazing thing, you wouldn't believe it. By accident, there was a crock pot here, and I bumped into the barley, and it fell in, and then it evolved, and the water came in, and all the spices, and it all happened by mistake. And evolution can explain it. You believe it, maybe you do, maybe you don't, fine. But what if I told you, aside from that, there was a recipe book, a cookbook, open right next to my challen that has the recipe right there. Would you believe it? It makes it so much more improbable. It just happened by itself, but really, then why is the recipe book right there? When we talk about cells and evolution of biological structures, that's amazing. Evolution, maybe. But you do realize that every protein, every cell, there's a cookbook sitting right next to it, explaining and outlining the structure of what that recipe ought to be. That's called your DNA. How did DNA come about? There's no point having a cookbook that doesn't actually build protein, which is the process of RNA, and if you remember your AP bio, there's no point in having it. Evolution has a very, again, it's a form of bilateral evolution, has a very difficult time explaining that. And perhaps the biggest contemplation I think we all need to think about, take a moment and really think. We talk about mankind. Elokai neshama shenasata bi tahorahi. The Lord, the soul you gave within me, it's pure. Ata barasa, ata nefachta bi, you created it. You blew it within to me. In an honest moment, if we're really honest, put your scientist hat on and your Torah Jewish hat, take it off. Do you really, really, really believe that mankind with our souls, and again, I love animals. My dog Cody is the cutest dog in the world. He's cuter than any of your dogs here. I'm sorry if I've offended you. He's adorable. He's an adorable dog. I love Cody. I believe Cody has emotion. Rambam even tells us, Rambam even writes, can animals maybe have a soul? Maybe. But do we really believe that my dog Cody is on the same plane as mankind? I don't believe it. I'm sorry. You could put your white lab coat on and say, yes, it's just an extension. That doesn't, my judgment, you have to ask yourself, don't listen to me. In your judgment, do you really believe that mankind is just a different form? It's just a more evolved form of my dog, Cody. Do you really believe that? I read a book in preparation for this class. I don't have it on me, but it was a book on Darwin and evolution. It was a history book, so that's why I'm allowed to read it. And they did a fascinating thing. North America, not Jews, North America. What percent of North Americans believe in strict Darwinian evolution? What percent of the North American population believes in strict evolution? It's about 12%. It's about 12%, and that number has been consistent for about 100 years. And again, not that that should therefore form all of our opinions, but I think there's a certain reason for that. Because I think if we're all honest, it's interesting. A lot of the arguments that evolution puts forward are fascinating. There are points to ponder. But the dots that are connected, I just don't find them compelling. And I just don't believe. I see mankind. I don't believe it. And I want to add one last point. People say, but it's science. Right there, that's even a mistake. When we talk about evolution being science, it's actually not true. Because science means it's something that I can replicate. We talk about scientific method and scientific theory. It's something that I can replicate. One of my rabbis gave it a great example. If we find you work for the police department, there's been a murder, and we found the blood, and you say, I ran the DNA, I ran the blood test, and it matches up with Jonathan. And we can place Jonathan at the scene of the murder, and we have it on the knife. We've got some hair from Jonathan. And therefore, I conclude Jonathan was the murderer. That last step is not scientific. Everything up until that point said we did a DNA test, and the likelihood of Jonathan's DNA, you know, not being the DNA that's found on that knife, is 1 to 3 billion. That's a scientific statement. The conclusion that we make from it is not a scientific statement. Jonathan was the murderer? No, maybe he wasn't. Maybe Benny was the murderer, and he happened to have been in Jonathan's house, and he got some hair on him, and that's how the hair got on the knife. Science needs to be repeatable. Science needs to be replicatable. By definition, anytime you're dealing with things from the past, we can't repeat it. It's conjecture. We look at different things, and we do our best. But it's not a scientific, it's not repeatable. It's not like chemistry or biology. It's like, again, I love history. Whenever you look at some things in history and we draw conclusions, realize that's not a scientific thing that you're doing. It's conjecture. And I think that's a very important distinction. I want to end with one last story. By the way, just one last thing. But Rabbi, didn't, what about that the bacteria in the petri dish? We can actually see evolution before our eyes. They can grow resistant to antibiotics. And the answer is 100%. That's microevolution. You can see species evolve briefly and survival of the fittest within a species. You can find extinction. But speciation, where one species, one antibiotic, one bacteria turns into a completely different form of bacteria, we have never been able to replicate that. Marginally, but not nowhere near, you know, what science, what evolutionary evolutionists believe. So we have to ponder that. I want to end with one last story. It's one of my favorite stories. I'm sorry I've gone a little over. If anyone wants to leave, I'm not insulted. But this is an amazing story, so you got to stick around for this story. I find this to be an inspiring story. In 1953, as you mentioned, Watson and Crick. It's 1950, they're trying to discover the molecular structure of DNA. They could tell that, and they had a strong theory that it was a code, and they knew the A, T, C, and G, but they couldn't get the structure. Now, we all know the structure, right? What does DNA look like? The double helix, right? Now, you know that picture, you've always seen DNA. They didn't know what it looked like back then. And the truth is, there were three teams of scientists, happened to all be in England at the same time, working on discovering what the molecular structure of DNA was. There was Watson and Crick, Maurice Wilkins, and Rosalind Franklin. Watson and Crick were, I forget what college, Maurice Wilkins and Rosalind Franklin were at a different college. They worked, they were in the same college. The problem is Franklin and Wilkins, Franklin was a very difficult person, and they didn't work together. They were essentially two, they may as well have been in different continents. There were different techniques. The way Watson and Crick were trying to figure it out is they were basically boys with toys. They had guesses of, they knew what the structure, the elements of DNA, they knew it was A, T, C, and G. They had theories, they could tell there were sugar molecules, deoxyribose. They knew there were nucleic acids, but they couldn't figure out how these things held together. So what they did was, if you know chemistry, you can literally map them out, draw them out, and try to put them together like Lego pieces to try to figure out how would this structure hold together molecularly. And that's what they did. They actually did it in three-dimensional. They would go to the metal shop in the basement of the college and actually come up with guesses on angles, distances, and measurements based on chemistry and try to put it together. But they were going nowhere. Rosalind Franklin and Wilkins, for that matter, were working on a totally different technique. What they did, the problem is DNA is a very stubborn and very long molecule. It's very difficult to see. What they did was, it was called, I'm going to forget it, it was called X-ray crystallography or something like that. Crystallography, thank you. Crystallography is the study of Christianity, but whatever, same thing. And what they did, what Franklin did, is, it's an amazing thing. Imagine you took an X-ray. An X-ray gives you like a silhouette. And that's fine, but if you're trying to figure out the shape of this water bottle, and all you get is a silhouette image on an X-ray, it's very hard to figure out what the 3D model of this thing looks like. So what you'd have to do, and also, aside from that, DNA is a very stubborn molecule, so you had to freeze it, hence the, not crystallography, but the, excellent. That's like 35 points in Scrabble right there, that's amazing. And just would just take these pictures and constantly, you know, take a picture, move it a billionth of an inch, take another picture, move it, and try to put together a composite image. And she was working on this. And there's this famous, I think it's like image 36. It's a famous, Google it, you'll see it. Rosalind Franklin, you'll actually see this X and you see these squiggles. It was the clearest picture that she ever got. They still didn't know. But the story goes is that Maurice Wilkins was in the same lab and he stole the X-ray file of Rosalind Franklin. Now keep in mind, it's 1953. Rosalind Franklin was a woman working in molecular biology. That was very atypical and unusual. So here you have the guy who steals her X-rays and shows it to Watson and Crick. Now, it didn't give them the eureka moment, but did give them a little bit of inspiration. And they realized that maybe the A-T's, C's, and G's, instead of facing outward, they faced inward. And they it gave them a little bit of an inspiration. And they realized maybe it's on a deoxyribose base, and the A-C's and T's and G's face inward. And they based on that, they started putting things together with the A-C's facing inward on a double sugar molecular thing and the double helix being, right, or like a helix strand. And they started putting it together. We stop the story right there. We know the end of the story. Watson and Crick and Wilkins are going to get the Nobel Prize and not Franklin. Scandal, right? No, it's actually not a scandal. She would have gotten the Nobel Prize, but sadly, she actually died. And the Nobel Prize could not be given, is never given posthumously. So and the truth of the matter is, Wilkins would write, and it is true. So it's like one of these revisions. She's like, whatever. This is the historian to me. A little bit of a revisionist history to say it was sexism. I mean, there was a little bit of it. It actually wasn't that bad. She actually really was a very annoying person to work with. She was, this is the reality. You're right. She was very difficult to work with. And Wilkins writes, it's like, yes, I stole this. But he said, I didn't steal it. It was in the lab and in any kind of healthy, normal situation. You look at other people's work. It's in the same, and like he said, it was a very dysfunctional relationship. But that's for a different time. The most amazing story, I find it to be one of the most inspiring stories. So they start putting together, you know, the A's, T's, and G's going inward, and they build this thing. And you can see it's actually in the college right there, the original model of the double helix. You ever see, we all know what it looks like. It's gorgeous, right? It's actually a very beautiful thing. And they knew they were onto something. If you're gonna read one book about molecular biology, I strongly recommend this book. It's really good. It's called The Gene by Siddhartha Mukherjee. It's a really good, right? I'm a rabbi making recommendations on molecular biology books. Like, I mean, it doesn't get worse than that. But it actually was a compelling read. It was really interesting. And there's a passage in this book that I found to be so inspiring. And if I could just take a moment to read it, two paragraphs. Maurice Wilkins came to take a look at the model the next morning. He needed but a minute's look to like it. The model was standing high on a lab table. Wilkins later recalled, it had a life of its own, rather like looking at a baby that had just been born. The model seemed to speak for itself, saying, I don't care what you think, I know I am right. He returned to London and confirmed that his most recent crystallographic data, as well as Franklin's, clearly supported a double helix. I think you're a couple of old rogues, but you may be well onto something, Wilkins wrote from London in March. I like the idea. Listen to this paragraph. Franklin saw the model later that fortnight, and she too was quickly convinced. At first, Watson feared that her sharp, stubborn mind, caught in her self-made trap, would resist the model. I mentioned she was a difficult person to work with. But Franklin needed no further convincing. Her steel-trapped mind knew a beautiful solution when it saw one. The positioning of the backbone on the outside and the uniqueness of the AT and GC pairs was a fact that she saw no reason to argue. Listen to the sentence. The structure as Watson described it was too pretty not to be true. The structure was too pretty not to be true. Now Isaiah tells us, Su'u einechem marom ru'u, mi bara eile. There's a religious, a Jewish charge. Study nature. There's a symmetry, a beauty in the Bria and the universe around us. And we talk about evolution, and no, it's all random. And I think we intuitively, we don't buy it, because the beauty inherent in every strand of DNA, every mountain, every sunrise, every baby that we see, we're inspired. Why? Because su'u einecha mara mara'u mi bara eile. You know, Franklin, she sees it. It's too beautiful not to be true. It's too pretty. That is the sign. That is the signature of God and his handiwork. Nature has a certain beauty, a certain harmony. My dad, a blessed memory, he always gave me that charge. He said, look at nature, study science, be inspired. That is actually a way to see the hands of God. You know, evolution, science, the Torah, it's tricky. I encourage each and every one of you, look at nature, look at the universe around you. Recognize, su'u einecha marom, raise your eyes to the heavens, u'ru'u, and perceive, mi bara eile, where did all of this come from? I want to thank you all for coming. I'll stick around if anyone has any questions, and please God, we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Jewish History Podcast.
As always, we'd really appreciate if you like and share this podcast, or even better, leave a comment. For more information, please visit us at www.lasvegascola.org.